The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra, everybody's favourite international break special. England have basically qualified. Slovenia tonight, Kane's the captain. It's bound to be a thriller. While Scotland could do with England's help to maybe get a playoff place. The luck of the Irish, Gareth Bale is injured. What will that mean for their game? Northern Ireland, a guaranteed second. They're up against Germany. We'll let you know what's what around the world as well. Plus, Harriet Yeovil, Pep's hoodies, your questions and feedback corner. And we promise to make it shorter than last week's, although we can't promise anything. Stellar panel today. Glendenning, Brassel and Wilson. Barry, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Andy Brassel, you well?
Excellent, thank you.
Before the pod, Andy confessed that he may look at a screen and it may not all come from his brain. And are you upset that I've outed you about such things?
Well, I felt ashamed enough anyway, but thanks for that.
Look at Barry, just covered in papers everywhere. Jonathan Wilson, how are the feet?
They're a little bit better, thanks. Not perfect, but a little bit better. But that's just the end of the cricket season, I think. I'm just not running as much.
And I misquoted you, or I defamed you in a Guardian article.
Yeah, you did. Barry, you said I was late, and I wasn't late. Everybody else was early.
Okay. Is an apology enough, or are you...
Yeah, no, I appreciate the on-air apology.
Yeah,
thank you.
I have to do it a lot. we're going to start with Wales and Ireland, because it's more interesting than England. Gareth Bale ruled out of Wales World Cup qualifiers with a calf injury. Did anybody see completely objective Irish journalist Barry Glendenning tweeting, "That's a shame, asterisk, sprints around house, fist pumping and cackling maniacally, asterisk"?
Well, I saw it because I wrote it.
Are you happy about this?
Yes. One man's calf muscle injury is another nation's source of great delight, I suppose. It's not kind, but that's life. So deal with it, Wales.
Last time they won a away qualifier without Bale was against Azerbaijan in 2009. Wales record without Bale since 06. 1-7, drew 10, lost 16. But what's great about Gareth Bale is, unlike other Welsh greats in the past, has turned up pretty much for every game.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to look beyond the Moldova game that Ireland have to play before they take on Wales at Cardiff. And despite the fact that Bale will be missing, you know, which is obviously a boost for Ireland and their players, I would agree with Roy Keane up to a point when he said that, you know, we're missing Seamus Coleman, we're missing John Walters, and they are very important players for Ireland. And in the Moldova game as well, James McLean and Robbie Brady are suspended, so there'll be big losses. I think on the balance of it, Wales without Bale are probably a better team than Ireland, or certainly have better players. And assuming Ireland beat Moldova, which I'm very reluctant to do, then personally I would fancy Wales to do a number or do enough against Ireland in Cardiff, but you never know.
Andy, do you fancy this will end in a winner takes all, maybe gets in a playoff, maybe misses out on a playoff?
That's the thing, next isn't it? Week? It's the possibility of winner takes nothing, really, especially with Bale dropping out of the picture, the fact that they may end up being the ninth second place team, whoever gets there. And that would be hugely deflating from, you know, what is an exciting match, I think, that last one, whichever way you look at it.
Yeah, but if you only win three games out of eight so far, which is true of both teams, what do you expect?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's funny, though. You look at the group and, you know, with the exception of, is it the one with Croatia, Iceland, Ukraine,
look at your screen, mate.
Etc. Yeah. Apart from that, it's lovely and is perhaps one of the most lovely and balanced. But the quality of football in the group's been really poor. I mean, you know, people have been expecting more from Serbia for a long time. Of course, they've had a lot of off-field stuff to deal with. But even though Serbia are a top and unbeaten, you do feel that, you know, they're not a spectacular side by any stretch of the imagination when you think of some of the natural talent they've had over the years.
Yeah, I mean, some of the groups, I mean, you look at England's group as well, don't you? And you just think, it's not inspiring, yeah. Again, and it's almost not fair. You know, it's sort of too easy compared to other groups where there are just better teams in it. I mean, it's how you seed it properly. Do you think that's a problem
I don't know, I'm not sure that's fair. I think the problem with Slovakia is they're a decent side, but essentially they're quite a dull side. You know, it's very hard to get excited about Slovakian football.
You're right, it is.
Yeah, I
do you think Slovakians are interested by Slovakian football?
I think maybe. There's a good friend of mine's going to the Slovakia v Malta game in Trnava, and there didn't seem to be any problem getting a ticket. Like, it's just not that people are flocking to that game. But I remember in the Euros, sort of, you know, one of the things you do as a journalist at a tournament is to read the sort of newspapers of the other teams in England's group or the groups you're focusing on. And there was genuinely nothing interesting in the Slovenian sports papers, the Slovakian sports papers. Slovenian sports papers are excellent. The Slovakian sports papers, absolutely nothing interesting there at all. You know, they the back page on one of the two sports tabloids there, the day before England played them, was something about UEFA coefficients. Now, I love a UEFA coefficient, but not that much, not then.
But aren't they all just busy playing handball and doing other things rather than being excited about football? I remember being in Slovenia and just agog. This was, I think, my first ever trip to Eastern Europe, and I had a lot of preconceived notions. So
Slovenia's not really Eastern Europe. Why have we moved on to Slovenia? Do you mean just move on to Slovenia?
Hmm?
Are we actually talking about Slovenia, or are we talking about Slovakia now?
No, I'm talking about... Oh, God, can we just... I'm talking about Slovenia. Everyone else is talking about Slovakia. I was in Ljubljana.
Anyway. Which is lovely.
Did you have a nice time, Barry? Let's keep it in. I'm enjoying this. I want Andy Brassel to come up with a defence for European countries that we know little about, beginning with S.
Well, to be fair, I know quite a bit about Slovenia.
Okay.
I've a chapter of Behind the Curtain. My first book is on Slovenia. Their only significant player before the breakup of Yugoslavia was he hit the bar with a header from outside the box against Brazil in the 1974 World Cup. And if I keep talking, his name might come back to Brane Oblak.
Okay.
Well done.
And he scored in the 9-0 win over Zaire. So were I ever on Pointless and 1974 World Cup came up, he would definitely be an answer.
Would he be a pointless answer?
Have you heard of him?
You bloody hope so. Seriously, if you said that on Pointless and it went down to one, it would only be Jonathan Wilson that they'd surveyed out of 100 people.
Actually, I remember on Pointless, an episode I saw, the thing that came up, it was some European Cup final, and the guy picked it, and he was asked to name, it was one Nottingham Forest had won. And he was asked...
Oh, no, I remember that one, yeah. And they obviously must have had, like, two Forest fans and the people they'd asked, because, like, it was, like, the two players who were Pointless were really obscure.
But he
got it. Frank Gray was one of them, I think.
He got it because he was a Forest season ticket holder. I'm pretty sure he got a Pointless answer. Because he said, I can name the entire squad, and that now I just have to pick the most obscure.
It must have been on just after my Clough book came out, because I remember I could name entire squads.
Is there anything we're going to talk about in this podcast where you won't plug one of your books? Because Argentina's coming up.
Well, the newest year, Blizzard, has just come out, so that's definitely worth a read. Theblizzard.co.uk, you can access it there. 600 articles there for free now.
They're so long, Jonathan.
You don't have to read all of it.
Surely you do, don't you, an article?
This is like people complaining about Monday's podcast. You know, it's so long.
There was a Pointless category which was famous people with the initials MR, and I got some stick.
Mike Riley.
That I wasn't. Mike Riley was on it, and I wasn't.
Mike Reed.
And I tweeted Richard Osman, and he replied going, come back when you're as famous as either of the Mike Reeds. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. Oh, should we talk about England-Slovenia then? Not many fascinating lines coming out of this. Gareth Southgate's going to get a £250,000 bonus if he qualifies for the World Cup, which they should do. Some people are up in arms about this. He's already paid £3 million a year, which, comparatively to other international managers, is a lot of money, Andy.
Yeah, it is. But I know it's not been spectacular in the early part of what's happened under Southgate, but I think this idea that England needed a big, sexy name to take them into the future...
Gareth.
It was just... I think it's nonsense. I think he's pretty much the best of what's available at the moment. You know, he's someone who understands the teams at various different age group levels, that's come from the right place. I think the idea that you have to be a, especially today, that you have to be a great club manager to be a great international manager is nonsense. I think you can see the way Spain have evolved since Julen Lopetegui has become a coach. And, you know, there's no one, I don't think, who would describe him as a good club manager. It's a completely different kettle of fish. And, you know, if English football, we're always talking about root and branch reform and reconstruction and all this sort of stuff. Well, that takes time. That doesn't mean throwing your toys out the pram after every tournament or every time you get a bit bored in a qualifying campaign.
Yeah, but there's an interesting point, which is he might be the right guy, and I tend to agree with you that he's done pretty much everything right. He was earning £500,000, and then he got the England job from the 21s, I think it was, and his salary goes up £2.5 million plus £250,000 for qualifying, £250,000 if he gets out of the group, and more and more and more. And it does seem like a lot. It seems like, you know, the FA just spend a lot of money on their managers.
Well, yeah, but there's two points there. One is he's not well paid compared to his predecessors. Maybe he is compared to Hodgson. Yeah. It's roughly equivalent to Hodgson, I think, but certainly not compared to Allardyce or to Capello. Mm-hmm. And secondly, if he was only on half a million, as soon as a championship club decides they want a manager, he's suddenly in the equation because they can pay him more. So, yeah, it's a lot compared to other national managers, but it's sort of, that's not the only factor you have to consider.
Good point. Harry Kane, Barry, who we talk about almost as much as we talk about Ryan Babel on this podcast.
More of whom anon.
Yeah, absolutely. He has a chef. Have you seen this story?
I saw something about him having a personal chef, yes.
Why is this a big deal? When Aidan McGinley was at Spartak Moscow, he had two. I don't know if that was like one for meats, one for fish, or
it was vegetable. It like he was doing a cooking competition every day, Aidan McGeady. And he would judge them both in a sort of Master Chef, McGeady's Russian Master Chef.
He'd give them 20 rubles each to buy a bag of ingredients and then hold up a green pepper or a red pepper, depending on which meal he liked the most.
There's a great clip you can find on YouTube of Leonid Slutsky on a Russian cooking show. Wearing sort of proper chef's hat and waving colanders and things about, like doing the cooking. Oh. So I think cooking shows in Russia are a boom market for football people.
Have you written a book about it?
About Slutsky? No, I haven't written about Russia, obviously, okay. Behind the curtain.
Do we care that Kane's the captain? Are we obsessed with captaincy? Should we be obsessed with captaincy, Barry?
English people, or certainly English journalists, seem to be obsessed with who's the captain. Personally, I think it really doesn't matter at all. But, it just seems to be a peculiarly English thing. Who's captain? Who's wearing the armband? It really doesn't matter. It's been discussed on the pod. Some people have very entrenched ideas. I personally think you lead the team out. You call heads or tails, and that's about it, really. I presume for Harry himself, it's a great honour, and, you know, it would be a great honour for anyone to captain their national side. But beyond that, I don't, you know. Marina Hyde famously likens it to the role of a regimental goat. You know, just it's there, but it's not important.
Interesting story about New York City's midfielder, Jack Harrison. Called up to the under-21s. He was a Manchester United youth team player, left at 14 to move to America. Scored 10 this season in the MLS. Missed his flight from New York and had to buy his own ticket to get over here. I don't know if anyone else is interested in that. Just an interesting thing that happened.
I think it's really interesting to see someone coming into the England under-21 setup, or any England setup, that I have absolutely no idea about. It's really interesting to have someone completely new to find out about.
Well, he'd kind of,
so I don't watch MLS at all, so I've no idea.
He'd kind of fallen out of the English system, hadn't he? So it's a bit of a career revival for him.
Yeah, well done, Jack, and good luck. Sam Allardyce is preparing to sue the FA, just in other England news, following comments that followed his England exits made by Martin Glenn. So we'll see how that one pans out. Scotland plays Slovakia on tonight, and then Slovenia on Sunday. They need to win both games to once again get into that position where they may be in a playoff or may not be in a playoff. But Gordon Strachan's had a bit of a revival, hasn't he, since almost the last 5 minutes of that England game where Lee Griffiths scored those goals.
Yeah. there was the game against, was it against Canada, that friendly, when they were absolutely dreadful. I think that really was an idea. And then they've picked up since then. They got beat 3-0 in Slovakia as well, didn't they, when just kept on getting done over.
Did the papers cover it in a big way, or
probably
stuck
not
on the coefficients?
I imagine it'd be sort of 250 words, sort of. This is exactly what happened in the game in a bland, tedious way. But what did happen in the game was lots of attacks down the Slovakian left, I seem to remember.
I guess the question is whether a good result or a decent result, or at least a decent stab at getting into second, should save Gordon Strachan. Because, of course, they started really well at the beginning of his era. Maybe it was because of what came before, but it all looked really fresh and exciting, as if they're going somewhere. I saw them beat Croatia, who were in a bit of a state at the time, but nevertheless, I saw them beat Croatia 2-0 at Hampden, and it seemed like they were pulling in the right direction. But if everything in the middle has just been really, really underwhelming, you know, should the bit at the beginning and the bit at the end make us forget about it?
Well, they were very unlucky, weren't they, in qualifying. Was it the last World Cup? Was it the year I was coming, when they lost to Poland at Hampden in a ridiculous game, when they conceded a very late Lewandowski goal, I think.
Yeah, that rings a bell-ish.
And there was, it seemed like a classic sort of Scottish glorious failure moment. But yeah, it doesn't seem to have... There was then clearly a dip after that.
Yeah.
Strachan has injury problems in midfield. He's lost Scott Brown. He's lost Stuart Armstrong. He's lost Matt Ritchie to injury. None of them will play in either of the two games. And there's sort of calls from... Callum McGregor, Celtic midfielder, has been playing very well for Celtic this season. He's in form, scored two good goals against Hibs last Saturday, I think it was. And he's been called in to the squad. He's never made a senior appearance, and there are calls for him to play. And it would be interesting to see if Strachan, who's pretty conservative, will actually start him. I think he should start, but the smart money seems to think that he will start Barry Bannon instead because he has more international experience, but he's, I don't think, anywhere near as good.
Northern Ireland, Germany. Germany, I think, have never lost a World Cup qualifier away from home, which is quite...
Well, not in 82 years.
Okay.
Which is decent, I think it's fair to say.
It's a good run of form,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's all right.
But Northern Ireland haven't lost at home in 4 years, I think. So something's got to give, or it'll be a draw.
Exactly. It's interesting how Jogi Löw's building it up, really, as this sort of winner takes all. It's got the feel of a big playoff and all the rest of it. I think if that would be a fair enough approach to take if there was the feeling of any complacency in the squad. But I don't really feel there is that with Germany anyway. If you look at what they did at the Confederations Cup with a really understrength team, of course, none of the Bayern players went, and pretty much everyone who went made the most of their opportunity. I mean, normally, in a situation where last summer, of course, they won the Euro under-21s as well, you would think a couple of those players would be pushing to get in the World Cup squad, and the under-21s have got no chance because they've got all the players in between from the Confeds who've pushed their way in as well. It's a huge competition, so I think there's no prospect at all of Germany letting up here. Of course, like Northern Ireland away, I think you have to look at the fact that they're clearly the best two teams in the group. It will be the most difficult game they've faced thus far. Certainly easier than them trampling over Norway, who are in this sort of transitional phase at the moment. But, you know, nevertheless, I think Germany, A, have that competition at the moment, and B, I think when you look at someone like Thomas Müller, who didn't go to the Confeds, for example, and certainly in terms of goal scoring, didn't have a great season last season. He had probably his worst season since he's become a first choice pick for Bayern last season. He's got something to do to not cement his place in the squad, but definitely cement his place in the 11. And the fact that Timo Werner's out will maybe help him do that, give him the opportunity.
Michael O'Neill, Northern Ireland manager, has a bit of a problem here. Like, they are guaranteed second place. You know, they're almost certainly not going to overtake Germany. It's possible, but it's very, very unlikely. But Northern Ireland need to get the best results they can to protect their world ranking, to ensure that they're one of the seeded teams in the playoffs, should they make the playoffs. I think there's also a danger they could miss out, but I might not be totally correct on that. He also has six players on yellow cards. You know, does he get them to, does he pick them for starters, or But because he's such a small squad of players, he can't really afford not to, or such a small pool of players to pick from. And yeah, it's how do they go about these games? Do they? He said he won't instruct his players to tiptoe through the games, but the players themselves will be aware. Oh, I'm one card away from a suspension, so you know he could be missing three or four key players for the playoffs, assuming they make those playoffs.
Elsewhere in Europe, I'll read out the groups and what can happen. And if you're interested or have a valid point to make, just pipe up. Group E, Armenia, Poland, Montenegro, Denmark. Poland need a point to guarantee a top two finish. They will clinch the group if they win and Denmark draw in Montenegro.
Denmark look decent. They look like they're really getting something together, don't they? Of course, Christian Eriksen, the fact that he's had an unbelievable 2017 is part of that. But there's quality all over the place elsewhere in the squad. You look at Dolberg, you look at Thomas Delaney, who's doing a great job for Werder Bremen. And Simon Kjær, of course, is playing at the best level he's played in a couple of years because he's left Fenerbahce to go over to Sevilla and he's playing a Champions League football there. So if Denmark can get there, I'm really interested to see how they get on at the World Cup.
Group G, Spain, Albania. Italy, Macedonia. Spain are assured of a top two finish, will qualify if they better Italy's result. Italy will be guaranteed at least second place if they draw. Interesting about Gerard Piqué saying he's going to stay with Spain, and why can't he talk about politics? You know, if a mechanic can, why can't he?
Yeah, it is interesting. And I think it was interesting as well the fact that he got put up for the press conference yesterday by the RFEF, and he didn't bat an eyelid, and he was very honest, very open, great speaker as he always is. And he's had to put up with a lot this week. Of course, he got whistled by some of the fans when he came on the pitch for the training session, and he's just dealt with it. I think you just have to enormously admire that. Of course, there is the fact as well that, I mean, I think people still underrate him in terms of what he is and what he has been in the European, the Spanish and the world game over the last, what, 7-8 years now. He's been incredible.
It's difficult to imagine a player from one of the home countries being that eloquent and informed about a political issue. I'm not saying they're not, but that they wouldn't be allowed to speak like that. They wouldn't be put up for the press, or they'd be hidden, you know, out the back in a box. So hats off to Spain for doing that. Sid was at his press conference and said it was remarkable. Just he offered to stay as long as it took to talk, answer every single question. I think in the end he had to be practically manhandled out because they had training to go to or something. I don't know.
But it's amazing. He's done it over a period of days, hasn't he? Yeah. You know, he's done it again and again. He's been on television, radio, obviously quite emotional at some points. But the fact that despite being very emotional, he's managed to retain his clarity, I think is absolutely incredible. And you can see exactly why people think of him as a future Barcelona president.
Group I, Croatia, Finland, Kosovo, Ukraine, Turkey, Iceland. Turkey and Ukraine will be eliminated if they lose and Croatia win. That scenario would guarantee Croatia and Iceland finishing in the top two. Jonathan, you've been in Iceland recently.
Yeah, I watched Iceland v Ukraine actually on TV in a student bar before an event I was doing. It emptied rapidly after the game before our event began.
What was your event?
It was
cabaret. This, come on.
I mean, it would have been better if it had been, to be honest. It was sort of a curtain raiser to the Reykjavik Literary Festival, and they thought it'd be a great idea to get, I think it was seven of us on the panel, to introduce cricket to an Icelandic audience. I suspect that the panel was rather larger than the audience by the end.
And how did you feel?
Drunk.
That's one way to get through it. So with the seven of you on a panel,
mm-hmm.
Four people watching.
Yeah, I wouldn't say all four of them were given their undivided attention.
Did you have any video clips, or were you doing their, you know, like Sky, go to a mocked up net?
Or the masterclass.
Yeah. Was that what happened?
No, the bloke presenting it was absolutely hammered as well. He'd obviously realised early that kind of this was not going well. So it was a pretty good panel. I mean, that Sebastian Falks was on it, Tom Holland was on it, but you know, pearls before swine.
Were you paid?
No.
It's not like you to do something for free.
Yeah, in retrospect, I regret it. But
did they pay for your flight?
No, because we were on a cricket tour, so it was just
okay, right.
So we played three games against the Iceland national team.
How'd you get on?
Lost the first two, won the third. Difficult conditions.
Isn't that basically though like a county cricket match? There's, you know, 13 lads out in the field and three in the crowd, and a dog.
Yeah, I mean there weren't three people watching the cricket. There's far fewer than that.
How do Icelandic wickets play?
It was indoor.
Okay.
That was part of the problem. So the 3G AstroTurf pitch. So some balls just skidded on and some really stopped in the pitch. It was very, very hard to get any fluency.
You got how many runs?
I tended to bat down the order. When I opened, I scored 10, which in context was fine. I was run out in both the first two games quite cheaply, chasing impossible targets. And
do your teammates try and run you out? Is it is
no, no, no?
Are you the Jeffrey Boycott of all?
I am. I mean, in terms of speed of batting, yes. But when they finally allowed me to bowl 3 overs 2 for 16, thank you very much.
Group A: Sweden, Luxembourg, Belarus, Holland, Bulgaria, France. France will win the group if they win and Sweden lose. France would guarantee a top two finish if they win. Sweden will secure a top two finish if Bulgaria fail to beat France and Sweden better Holland's result. On my paper. It says Andy wants this. Holland out if they fail at least to match Sweden's result. Bulgaria need to win to stay in contention. So, a lot to play for.
Yeah, I think it should be pretty straightforward for France, but it should and will be are two different things, I think, because it's this kind of thing in the back of a lot of French minds, the fact that when they lost in the last qualifier of the 1994 World Cup, of course, where David Ginola tried that crossfield pass at the Parc des Princes and didn't come off, that was against Bulgaria. So the fact they're going to Bulgaria in this penultimate game, the fact that they failed to beat Luxembourg, so they're kind of out of snookers. They just have to win these games and not think about anything else. They're quite capable of doing it, of course. One of Bulgaria's best player, Popov, who plays at Spartak, he's out suspended. So it should be okay for them. But then again, Bulgaria tripped up Sweden last month. And yeah, they do have this kind of Bulgaria phobia that they need to get over.
And Bulgaria have won all four home games so far, haven't they?
Yeah.
You know that game in 93, when Bulgaria won 2-1? So you remember the Ginola cross goes over the box, Lubislav Penev picks it up, runs forward, plays to Kostadinov and scored. Neither Penev nor Kostadinov had a valid visa. They're both in the country illegally.
So we should replay that match.
I mean, I'm sure Gerard Houllier would.
He certainly would
say that, yeah. Yeah, but
how did you come by that information?
Were you researching a book?
Yeah. I was talking to Bobby Mikhailov, you remember the Reading keeper with the weave. I was talking to him and he told the story. And yeah, I checked it and it was true. Nobody in France seemed aware of it. It was when I was doing my goalkeeper's book, actually. It's a different book, it's one we haven't mentioned yet, The Outsider.
I've actually read that.
Have you?
Yeah.
Not that many people have. The Bulgarian FA had basically just forgotten to apply for visas for their two best players, essentially. But Mikhailov and Georgiev played for Mulhouse in eastern France. And they knew this border post that they knew was not very well manned.
So they smuggled
them through the border and they stayed at Georgiev's house. And then there was this travel company based in Paris who were annoyed with the French FA because they'd lost some contracts. He put them up in the Trianon Palace. And yeah, there was not the normal security you get in a hotel. So the two of them didn't have proper permits and combined to... Well, Kostadinov got both goals, in fact, didn't he?
And to think that David Ginola has been living with the guilt for all these years.
Hey, Barry, if you were to go on Amazon reviews for The Outsider, how many stars and what would your comments be for that book?
I enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed it a lot more than the 10 to 15 pages of Inverting the Pyramid I got through. I had it sitting on my bedside table for a long time. It took me a long time to get through because it was like reading 20 minutes before bed each night. And so, but yeah,
it put you to sleep though, right?
Not in that way. No, I genuinely enjoyed it. I find goalkeepers fascinating.
It got 4.2 out of 5. That's what its current review state is.
So
that's not bad.
Yeah.
You know, you'd take that Uber, wouldn't you?
If you saw 4.2. You would, that's true.
Group B, Andorra, Portugal, Switzerland, Hungary. Switzerland yet to drop a point. Portugal certain to finish in the top two. At worst, the playoffs. Group C, and then if anyone wants to stop me on Group B, now's the time.
I would, actually.
Because, no, Andy, come in.
Of course, it's all set up for the final game in Lisbon between Portugal and Switzerland. And I think most people, while they're sniggering about Granit Xhaka being Swiss Player of the Year, are thinking that it's going to be pretty straightforward for Portugal. Of course, they have to go to Andorra and not muck that up first. And, you know, Andorra do get stuck in, and they don't have a great 3G pitch, unlike the one that Jonathan was playing on in Iceland. Or maybe it's similarly inconsistent. I don't know.
The pitch is actually funded by Eidegger Jansson.
Really?
Yeah.
What a guy.
Sorry, carry on.
Oh yeah,
Why does he do the Andorran pitch?
No, the pitch in Reykjavik.
Oh right, I see. I zoned out. Carry on.
Other listeners are like Max.
You can edit that bit out. I was like, maybe he's just really generous. Maybe when he was in Barcelona, he went on a trip to Andorra, had a nice time.
I can't say he didn't fund it. I don't know who didn't fund it.
There you go. I have been getting some criticism for when I draw a diagram of the pod. And I draw Spain for Sid. I haven't yet got the Pyrenees particularly correct. So I apologise for that as well.
It's like when you do the UK as a sort of deformed coat hanger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, there's time to learn. Have you finished? Did you finish your...
No, I was going to say that Portugal, that they always make a meal of qualifying. Give or take the last Euros, where they made a meal of the group stage instead before going on and winning it. I think the idea that Switzerland are just going to be a pushover, I mean, they've won 8 out of 8 so far, and they did beat them quite comfortably in Basel in the first game. So, you know, Portugal need to afford them some sort of respect.
Group C. Sorry, Barry.
If I could quickly go back to Group A.
Of course you can, yeah.
We are obliged to mention that Ryan Babel has earned a recall to the Dutch squad at the expense of Wesley Sneijder, who's been dropped. And it just seems a bit worrying that their best player is still Arjen Robben, and they're almost certainly not going to qualify.
Mm. So. Essie had written on after Monday's pod, why no mention of Ryan Babel on the pod? I'm lobbying for a Babel on Babel, a 1 minute blurb of Babel each pod. So there you are, Essie, that one's for you. Finally, Group C, Bosnia Herzegovina versus Belgium, Cyprus, Greece. Belgium have qualified top. Bosnia Herzegovina will seal second if they win and Greece lose.
No Miralem Pjanic for Bosnia, though. We talk about Wales missing Bale. I mean, that's pretty much as big.
Yeah, and that's the group that might let Ireland/Wales through as the best runner-up.
Okay.
It's one of the 8 best runners-up.
Pjanic stations for Bosnia.
Very good. Have you seen this venue in Russia? The Ekaterinburg.
Yekaterinburg.
Ekaterinburg.
No, Ye. There's a Ye before the E.
Yekaterinburg.
Yeah.
Good. Arena. Didn't meet the minimum capacity requirements. So they're just... built an extra stadium out of the stadium.
That's going to be my first World Cup game. It's the second day. So I thought I'd go to Yekaterinburg first because it's where the Romanovs were killed. So I thought, you know, 2 or 3 days before the tournament, a good bit of history first. Yeah. Watch the opening game in a bar there and, that'll be my first match next summer.
Someone on Twitter, sorry, I can't remember who to credit them, but they made the point that looks exactly like the stand... Maud Flanders fell off to her death when Homer accidentally shot her with the t-shirt gun. So if you end up sitting at the back of that, Jonathan, be very careful.
It also looks like you'd have a restricted view anyway, because the sort of the roof or the sort of bit at the top seems to be in the way. So either way, you won't see the game and you'll fall off and die. So
have you read about the Romanovs, their deaths?
No.
I read the Montefiore book on Romanovs, which was brilliant, really good. But I sort of assumed that... I don't know, I hadn't really thought about it at all, but I've seen the film, Nicholas and Alexander, and know how that is. So they're in this basement room, the firing squad go in to shoot them, and they're all just told to sit down. And, you know, you think the firing squad fire, and that's it, all done. But each of the firing squad have been given a particular one to aim at, and they all just aimed at the Tsar. So like the smoke clears and he's dead, his body kind of shattered into a million pieces, and all the rest are sort of sitting there still going, shit. And they end up having to try and bayonet them, and because all the women are wearing corsets, the bayonets won't go through the whalebone. So that's why it's a complete mess. And that's why, I don't think it is true, but that's why the Anastasia myth may not be quite as preposterous as it first sounds, that it was such a botched effort that somebody escaping is not completely inconceivable.
Either of you have anything to add to the Romanovs?
So the bodies are put down a well, and I think Putin is still contemplating whether to have them DNA tested to find out if it actually is them.
Oh, well, keep us posted.
Yes, I will, don't worry.
All right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll go around the world. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. South America. It says in brackets, Barry and Jonathan are into this. Andy, you're welcome to contribute, even if you're not into it.
Thank you.
Final round of games kick off at 12:30 Tuesday night, Wednesday morning. And Jonathan, a real possibility of Argentina going out?
Yeah. I mean, there's a possibility. I don't think they will. They're fifth in the group, which is enough for a playoff, which would be against New Zealand. So you'd expect them to win that, even if they did have to go into that. I think what benefits them is Chile and Ecuador. Their form's dropped off a cliff. But then Argentina, last four games, they only scored two goals, one a penalty, one an own goal. They're not playing well. There's no great fluency there. And they have to go to Ecuador, is the final game, which is at altitude, where historically Argentina seem to struggle more than any other South American team. And the game tonight is against Peru, who have won the last three games 2-1. And they're now in fourth. And possibly on the brink of a first World Cup qualification since 1982.
Why has Sampaoli not had the impact that people hoped he would? Because they wanted him for so long.
It's two games. I mean, I think that's the issue. I think there's a mental thing that, there's sort of two things gone hand in hand. One is the fact that Argentina haven't won a trophy since 1993, and that clearly has begun to bother them, especially with losing in the four finals recently. Mm. Messi, when he retired, you know, that brief period he had when he wasn't playing national football, said he felt cursed. And I think there's a sense that, you know, there's, for reasons that aren't really their fault, things have gone wrong. And now things are their fault. You know, AFA's, you know, lack of funding for youth football, mm-hmm. the violence still haunts the domestic game. All those problems are mounting up. And this squad of players, they had this great conveyor belt of talent for 20-odd years, and this feels like it's coming to the end of it. I mean, obviously, you've got people like Dybala and Icardi coming through, but they're not Messi, they're not Tevez, they're not Aguero, they're not Di Maria. They're not there in that sort of that concentration. Dybala said an interesting thing this week. He said it's very hard to play with Messi. And that obviously caused panic. But then you listen to what he was saying, and he was sort of saying, well,
for him, that makes sense, though.
Messi
doesn't it?
Is so good, and it's, you know, he finds himself always saying, should I just give a ball to Messi? You know, he's not playing his natural game. He's second guessing what Messi's doing. I think they've had a problem with the midfield, that they don't get goals from midfield, with Biglio and Benega. Two good players, but they don't get forward. So that makes Messi drop deeper and deeper, and that takes him away from dangerous areas. That then puts pressure on the wing backs, and Di Maria's playing at left wing back, which isn't necessarily his natural game. Now, in theory, Sampaoli's approach, playing the hard-pressing game, going high up the pitch, should help solve that. There'll be less room for Messi to drop back into. But it's not the ideal time to try and implement that when you're panicking at the end of a qualification campaign.
Short of Brazil and, say, Germany, Argentina seems to be the next side that just absolutely have to be at a World Cup.
They haven't failed to qualify since 1970. And that was also against Peru, which has, you know, created a lot of comment. Having said that, you know, they qualified by the skin of their teeth in 2010 by beating Peru with a very late Martin Palermo goal in the rain. But in 1969, they were in a three-team group with Bolivia and Peru, and Humberto Maschio was the coach, and he'd sort of create a separate squad to go to Bolivia to play at altitude. You know, it's trained them especially for altitude. And then the whole of AFA was sacked 2 weeks before the qualifiers started. You know, the leadership, the coaches, everybody. Adolfo Pedernera came in, sort of ignored the whole thing about having a separate squad. They went to Bolivia, lost. They went to Peru and lost, beat Bolivia at home, then drew 2-2 against Peru and didn't go through, which is obviously a huge embarrassment. That game is definitely playing on minds.
Jonathan, I'm surprised you haven't mentioned it yet, but you've written a book about Argentinian football.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it's out in paperback now. It came out last month in paperback.
Great. Well, I haven't got around to reading that one yet. Could you tell me, it's just I was reading up on the whole history of Argentina and Peru during the week. Is there any concrete evidence that the game they played at the 1978 World Cup in Argentina, which Argentina won 6-0 to ensure their passage through to the final, I think it was, they needed to win 4. Is there any... There are a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding that game. Is there any evidence, concrete evidence, that it was a fix?
I have to say, I'm really unconvinced either way. I just don't know. Some really weird stuff happened.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of allegations, which are very hard to stand up this far after the event, about there being a quantity of grain belonging to Peru that had been sort of held at Argentinian ports that was suddenly released, they say. But the records seem impossible to get hold of. There's talk of a exchange of political prisoners.
Yeah.
There's this horrible thing called Operación Condor between a lot of the right wing dictatorships at the time, where they essentially swapped political prisoners so they could torture them over, not in their own soil. Did that have anything to do with it? Very hard to say. What the Peruvian players who played say is that they were visited before the game by the Argentinian president and also Henry Kissinger, which is a really weird thing. But then I asked Henry Kissinger's office, did this actually happen and what was he doing there? And got the reply, Dr. Kissinger has no recollection of this incident, which I suspect is true of a lot of what he got up to in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, but his name did crop up in some of the
But if you watch, the thing is, if you watch the game, it's the weirdest fixed game you've ever seen if it's fixed, because Argentina absolutely batter them, and the Peru goalkeeper, Ramon Quiroga, who's born in Argentina and got a lot of the flack, that people said, oh, he's born in Argentina, of course he wants Argentina to win. He makes 3 or 4 incredible saves in the first half. Peru hit the post just before half-time as well. So I think if you just saw the game, you'd think, okay, here's a team who've already gone out, who are getting battered. It's a really hostile crowd in Rosario, in Yawajita. And in the second half, they just bottle it a bit, I think is what you'd say if you watched the game. But there is all this other weird stuff in the background.
Brazil are out of sight at the top of the group. Uruguay second, Colombia third, Peru fourth, Argentina, we've mentioned, fifth.
So yeah, Uruguay could wrap up qualification if they win in Venezuela. Venezuela have only won one game, but they have drawn their last two, so they are showing certain signs of stubbornness. Colombia would they wrap it up? Absolutely. They wrap up at least the playoff place, wouldn't they, if they were to beat Paraguay at home. And Chile v Ecuador, two sides who started well and are dropping. And whoever loses that is out, and so both sides need to win to sort of stay in the hunt.
So before we do Africa, Australia, Syria, that kicks off at 1:30 p.m. So it's almost in the Snodgrass vortex of football matches where it hasn't happened before we've finished recording, but it's definitely happened after you've had any chance to listen to it. The winner plays fourth place of CONCACAF. Which is currently tight between Honduras, the United States and Panama. Mexico, top of the group, 18 points, they've qualified. Costa Rica have got 15. So the United States-Panama is a big game. Jonathan?
They met in the Gold Cup this summer when it was a 1-1 draw. The USA went out to Panama in the quarterfinal, I think 2 years ago, on penalties. So recent history there. But the last four games have all been 1-1 draws between them.
Interestingly, we did get some stick from both Australians and New Zealand. New Zealanders specifically, when we just said, well, it doesn't really matter. New Zealand will lose that playoff to whoever they play in South America. Does anybody want to stick up for New Zealand at all? Any chance about who they play in fifth place in
I wrote South an America? Article sticking up for them the last time they were one of those playoffs, and they were rubbish, so no.
Having slagged off Slovakia, I think one of the reasons that I'm so irritated generally by Slovakian football is the worst game of football I've ever been to was in Rustenburg during the 2010 World Cup when I went to Slovakia v New Zealand. And it is the... I can't remember what the score was, but it was a dreadful game. I've got no idea what the score was.
0-0, aren't you?
If there weren't many goals, certainly.
Did New Zealand draw all their games?
I think they might have done, yeah. 0-0 or 1-1.
They went out of the World Cup without losing a game.
Being in the mix zone afterwards, which is... Yeah, for people who don't know, it's a bit between the dressing and the bus where journalists can talk to players. And normally it's this terrible bun fight of journalists are fighting over each other, sticking their dictaphones over this metal railing, going, Wayne, or whoever.
It's very undignified.
It is very undignified, and I try and avoid it if I possibly can. That is the only mix I've ever been to where the players were begging the journalists to talk to them. And there's this one, like, no, I'm a New Zealand second choice goalkeeper. I've just finished my degree. Well done, mate. Thanks.
So, yes, so if you are from New Zealand, then you can abuse
he
us.
He seemed
some
a
more.
Lovely bloke, and I was very okay. glad he'd done his degree. I think it was in something like marine biology or something. Oh, it sounded very useful. Okay. But it wasn't what I needed to immediately file my copy.
Africa, Wilson.
Right, Group A, Tunisia will qualify if they get a better result away to Guinea than DR Congo get at home to Libya, which is slightly disappointing because I had high hopes for this DR Congo team, and the fact they haven't been to a World Cup and are a massive football nation, it would have been nice to see them there, but that looks like it's going to be Tunisia. Nigeria in Group B, they'll qualify if they beat Zambia. If that's a draw, then they're 3 points clear of Zambia, with a goal difference of 5 superior. So if effectively, if Nigeria avoid defeat to Zambia, they qualify for the third World Cup in a row. Then the other three groups are a lot tighter. Group C, Ivory Coast, who've got a load of injuries, they go to Mali, and they're 1 point clear of Morocco, who are at home to Gabon, who are only another point further back, so three teams could qualify there. Group E next. Egypt will qualify with a win against Congo, if Uganda lose at home to Ghana. Uganda got to the Cup of Nations this year for the first time since the 70s, so they're clearly a growing force. But realistically, Egypt should get there, which, to be honest, you know, we've kind of been waiting for them. You know, they haven't been at the World Cup since 1990. They've won 4 Cups of Nations in that time. They were very unlucky to lose to Algeria, if you remember, in a playoff before the 2010 tournament. And obviously huge political upheaval there 4 years ago. And then the other group, which in some ways is the most interesting, the most complicated. Burkina Faso, top of the group with 6 points. Cape Verde have 6 points. So Burkina Faso are away to South Africa this week. And Cape Verde are at home to Senegal. I really like this Burkina Faso side. Never qualified for World Cup before. They were really good at the Cup of Nations. Played really nice control passing football. Charles Kabore, back in midfield. Former Marseille captain, was he? But he's certainly midfielder.
No,
he
played for him, though.
And Aristide Bonsai, the great journeyman. 17 clubs or something up front. Totally mad. Huge crowd favourite. And I really like their goalkeeper as well, Eve Koffi. Is it Lille? And the left back, Yakuba Koulibaly, who's at Le Havre, I think.
Yeah.
I'd like to look at him in January. But that grief's complicated by the fact that the game in which South Africa beat Senegal, which was the second game.
Is that the one where the ref is the
ref,
dodgy?
Joseph Lamptey, the Ghanaian, yes. has got a life ban. So they're going to have to replay that game, which, given South Africa won it 2-1, there's a chance for Senegal to make up ground, which makes it harder for Burkina Faso or Cape Verde.
Of all the teams, you know, who could still qualify, who do you think has the potential to make the most impact in Russia?
Of the African teams, none of them, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. I think what's happened with African football in the sort of, you know, I went to my first Cup of Nations in 2002. And you look at some of the sides there, you know, Cameroon won it, and they something like that had just come into the team, I think it was 17 or 18. They had Patrick Mboma up front, you know, real quality forward. Jeremy was in that team, Rigobert Song. You know, it was a really good, strong side, quality across the pitch. You had Senegal got to the final, so that was a Senegal of Diouf and Diaw and Khalil Fadiga. Ferdinand Colley, you know, again, you have 6 or 7 really high class players. That Nigeria team had Kanu, had JJ Kocha, it had Sunday Elise, Tariba West. Yeah, loads and loads of good players. I think any of those three sides would walk a couple of nations these days. I think there's a side anywhere near that level.
It's strange.
What
that,
has
isn't
happened,
it? It's
though,
strange, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've seen a particularly good explanation for it. But what has happened,
well,
I think,
sorry,
is
that... Sorry, at the risk of sort of going into the world of cliche and stereotype, is it not a problem that a lot of these teams seem to just disintegrate behind the scenes once they get to a World Cup and there's rows over bonuses and wages?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that doesn't help. Yeah, there's a whole load of issues with reimbursing players. often with paying coaches, there's problems of basic logistics. But it's not as if you can point to one African country now and say, look at the great wealth of players they could choose from. Cote d'Ivoire, up until 3 or 4 years ago, you could certainly say that. They just got a string of really tough draws, I think, at World Cups, sort of undermined them when they had the Touré brothers and Drogba and Sakura. But yeah, now I don't think there's any side anywhere near that level. But what has happened is that the sort of the mid-ranking teams in Africa, the teams sort of 8th to 12th, are now much stronger than they were 15 years ago.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan. That'll do for the World Cup. We'll be back with part three when we discuss just various things and some questions and feedback corner. Welcome back to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Harry Redknapp at Yeovil. Darren Way, the manager, has asked Harry to help in an advisory role with the first team. I actually interviewed him on the radio this morning, and he said
Darren Way.
No, Harry Redknapp.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he said he was just going for a cup of tea, and he's just going to sort of help out in a sort of advisory, just see what he can do, see if he can help out. Any thoughts on this?
Well, unless he's been foisted upon Darren Way, and I don't know, anyone who's seen the first episode of the new series of Curb Your Enthusiasm will appreciate the amount of work and initiative that can go into a good foist. I don't see the harm in it. A young manager could certainly learn from Harry. I'm not sure how clued in Harry is on that particular division. You know, he said recently that he'd struggle to name 7 Watford players. So I quite how much he knows about Yeovil's first team, I don't know. But yeah, he's, you know, he gets painted often correctly as this sort of buffoonish caricature, but he does have a lot of experience and wisdom, and why not pass it on if someone wants to bend his ear and get the benefit of it?
The thing is, a lot of people are suspicious of Yeovil, or a lot of Yeovil fans are suspicious of Yeovil because of the way that the club has been run in recent years. So I'm sure a few of them will have a word to say about it.
I'm ignorant of this story.
Well, the club's just been really badly run over the last couple of years. A lot of the fans have been in conflict with the leadership of clubs, with the owners, with their motivation. And of course, they've dropped down a couple of divisions in successive seasons.
That completely passed me by.
Well, actually, on a radio show quite recently, Barry spent 5 minutes on air finding where Yeovil was on Google Maps. So,
did I?
Yeah, it's not half as far southwest as we thought it was.
Oh yeah.
It's sort of quite near Bristol. From Yeovil to the Big Six, this sort of quite dry but probably quite important thing about the top six clubs demanding more money from international TV rights that presumably could spill over into all TV rights, not getting their way because you need 14 votes to pass anything.
By any chance, did they just get 6 votes?
No.
Or maybe 8, 9?
I think West Ham and Leicester, if I'm right.
So they clearly have notions above their station.
Well, maybe. I might be wrong on that. But Mr. Small on Twitter says, let's talk about the inevitable breakaway Super League, which is the ultimate end to this. But it is kind of important that the money is spread evenly, isn't it, to keep the competition?
Yeah, I mean, you look at what's happened in France, Italy, Germany, Spain to a slightly lesser extent, and yeah, their leagues are, yeah, you know who's going to win the league, or you know who's going to be top 2 before the season starts. I mean, we know who's going to be top 6, but rather a top 6 and a top 1.
So it's short-sighted of the Big Six, because you can understand why they think they deserve more money, because more people are interested in seeing them.
It probably is short-sighted. I mean, I guess they might justify to themselves as saying they're only asking for 35%. Would that have a massive effect? And maybe it wouldn't have a massive effect, but you know, it's the thin end of the wedge.
It's not just TV money as well, is it, that decides in terms of entrenching a club's position in the league? I mean, Paris Saint-Germain, that's something completely different. You know, that's not to do with television money. You think there's egalitarianism in Germany And you know, Bayern is still a lot bigger than everyone else. So that doesn't make a huge difference. But I think given that the Premier League's, I guess, marketability around the world is built on the fact that it is equal and everyone gets a fair go of it, maybe makes us a little different.
I mean, do you think one day, Theo says, what's stopping Premier League teams from setting up league passes to watch their games like the NBA or the NFL, cutting out broadcasters?
Well, a lot of people have brought that up, but the fact is at the moment is, why would the clubs want to go to the bother? You know, they get so much money above market value from Sky and BT. Surely they're in a terrific position anyway. Why would they want things to change? And, you know, it's just been climbing and climbing and climbing beyond what you would consider being reasonable. I mean, I don't know. I often look at it and think, how can Sky and BT continue to make money out of that? But it keeps climbing anyway.
But it, I mean, it's also that the Premier League's constitution, you know, as you say, you have to have 14 out of the 20 votes to change anything. So they're not going to vote to allow you to break free of the cartel.
And also, you can't have the equivalent of NBA League Pass when you've still got the 3 p.m. blackout, can you?
Good point.
I mean, in terms of where the rights are going, speaking to people at the Premier League, they're talking about they're just beginning the early stages negotiating for
Facebook
the
coming in and Amazon
Netflix.
Well, I mean, that's being mooted, but in terms of the value they expect to get, I think they're talking about getting roughly $1 billion more for domestic rights when the next one's negotiated. So they go from 6 to 7, and then overseas rights to go from 3 to 5. So they still see overseas rights as being the, I mean, okay, it's only an extra billion, but that's increasing by 60-odd% rather than increasing by 16%.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you want competition, or it's fair that there's competition, but I suspect most fans would just like it all to be in one place because that saves them money and makes their lives easier.
I don't think TV money's a complete red herring. Of course, it is important, but on the other hand, like, I think the struggles of English teams, especially in the Champions League in recent years, have shown that it's not just about money. Because, you know, when the last TV deal was signed, you had presidents of clubs in France and Spain saying, we can't compete, they're going to be playing a different sport now. And then you get a few years further down the line and you realise, well, you know, money's not a replacement for strategy. And that's maybe something that the Premier League's still learning.
I think as well, Max, it's slightly naive of you to think that the needs of fans would even be the remote consideration, because it's just not. You know, as we see, it looks like Sky are going to schedule 2 games for Christmas Eve this year, which would entail travelling Liverpool fans trying to get to and from London on Christmas Eve, travelling Newcastle fans trying to get to and from London on Christmas Eve.
And the only thing that might stop that is that they might not be able to get the stewards for the Arsenal game.
And speaking of somebody who habitually makes that journey from London to the North East on Christmas Eve or December 23rd, it's really, really annoying and difficult anyway.
Travelling anywhere on Christmas Eve is chaotic at the best of times. But, you know, the clubs can't complain, because all they had to do was have a vote and agree when they were signing their contract with Sky, we will not have games on Christmas Eve. But they either didn't think of it or just didn't bother. But the needs of fans are not a consideration at all, and anyone who says otherwise is very naive or else just deluded.
You know what, I do think there is an opportunity for fans, especially working with organisations like the FSF, to do something. People say that fans have got absolutely no power. I don't think that's true. I think, you know, bear in mind when Arsenal got their game against Leicester, was it the season that Leicester won the league, so this would be probably about 16 months ago, moved to Valentine's Day, didn't they? With, I think, 6 weeks' notice or whatever, and fans were up in arms and saying, well, people have already bought train tickets and all the rest of it. The rest of Europe just laughed at that story. If you go to Spain and Portugal, and they're making efforts to become less bad like this, because obviously it has effect in terms of overseas television schedules and priority on those television schedules, not because of the fans. But, you know, fans in those countries have been mucked about for years. You know, you've had derbies between Sporting and Benfica in Portugal where tickets have gone on sale when they've decided the definitive time and day, which has been 8-9 days before the game's kicked off. So it's not got quite that bad.
So fans here shouldn't complain, or?
No, I'm not saying they shouldn't complain at all. I'm saying it's not as bad as it is in other countries. So they should take the opportunity, A, to make sure it doesn't get any worse, and B, to realise the fact that part of the Premier League's global appeal is those fans. So they've got to use that power, I think, to mobilise. The problem is, I think, is whenever, like, and you know, I know a Twitter discussion is a vacuum of, in a sense, but whenever someone will say, "Oh, it's disgraceful that Arsenal are charging £65 to get in against Manchester City," loads of Arsenal fans will chip off about it. Or, you know, not necessarily Arsenal fans, it could be any other club. But people take things always as an attack on their club rather than this is an issue that affects all of us as football fans and maybe we should work together to make sure it's not acceptable. And it's something that the FSF have made headway with.
It's non-league day on Saturday, to another end of the scale, which I think raises money for prostate cancer. Dulwich Hamlet, in non-league news, are donating money from their league sponsorship deal with a betting company to charity. They've promised that any money the club receives from their league's new sponsorship deal with a betting company will be donated to charities tackling gambling addiction. Last month, the Isthmian League, made up of clubs in the 7th and 8th tiers of English football in London and the South East, agreed a deal with Betting.net to sponsor their Performance of the Month and Fair Play Awards. That's interesting from Dulwich Hamlet to do that, isn't it? Because that's quite a lot for a club at that level. Any money is a lot of money, isn't it?
It's a highly commendable and... I would like to think more clubs would follow suit, but because bookmakers and gambling are becoming just an all-pervasive, insidious influence on football. I think I read somewhere recently that, I can't remember the exact figure, but a genuinely disturbing number of 8 to 10-year-olds can name 6 bookmakers off the top of their heads because of ads they've seen watching football. I remember our own Sport Ed, Owen Gibson, who's been on the pod many times, it was mentioned one day that he was watching a match with one of his kids and his Ray Winston's massive floating head came on and his kid turned to him and said, "Oh, are we having a bet on the game?" You know, and Owen said, "No, it's possible to watch football without having a bet." So, yeah, hats off to Dulwich Hamlet, who, you know, have loads of initiatives, and they're at home on Saturday. I'd have gone, except I'm confined to barracks here in the office. But I would recommend anyone to go to Champion Hill for a day out. It's just an interesting club, very well run. You know,
there's a balance to be had.
A bit achingly trendy for my taste, yeah. But you know, yeah, I like going to watch them play.
That betting thing's interesting though. But there's a balance to be had, isn't there? I mean, you can't just, or would you just have it not part of football at all? It's so interlaced with. You think about the number of Premier League sides that
one twists your arm. There are a lot of problem gamblers. No one twists their arm to have a bet. I like a bet, you know, but it's not something that affects my life. I know people whose lives have been absolutely ruined by gambling. And what annoys me is the bookies pretend that they care and they don't. They really don't.
Good night for English sides in the Women's Champions League last 32. Chelsea beat Bayern Munich 1-0. Drew Spence scored the winner. Manchester City beat St. Poulton 3-0 in Austria. The England trio of Demi Stokes, Steph Houghton and Nikita Paris with the goals there. Did anybody see Stan Collymore's quote about Pep Guardiola? Here's the quote. "Pep Guardiola doesn't have to go all Tony Pulis by wearing the club shop. But if he doesn't want to wear a suit on the touchline, he should at least don a tracksuit. There's a standard of dress at some of our great cathedrals of football. And while Stone Island is fine for the stands, it's not fit for Premier League dugouts." So there stands views on what Pep should wear or what he wouldn't wear. I quite like his casual approach.
You know what you're getting with Guardiola. Mm. And he's been a Stone Island man all the way. That's why his union with the Premier League was always inevitable.
I mean, he says there are standards. There aren't. There is no dress code. So, you know.
Who's your favourite? I mean, I do like the matching shirts of Joachim Löw and his assistant. You know, the tight white.
I would be a suit and tie manager myself.
Yeah, actually, the one thing that gets on my nerves a little bit is where, like, French coaches you see now and then wear quite nightclubby jeans on the touchline. You know, maybe rips, which I think is quite undignified for a man in his 40s anyway. But
No, same in Argentina, the sort of the jeans and a T-shirt. Yeah, come on, you're a manager. It's...
Yeah.
So some level of, I sort of agree, some level of smartness. How you define that, I guess, is up to you. But
You are a manager.
You shouldn't look like you're going out, basically.
Yeah.
On the subject of Pep, one of his former clubs, Bayern Munich, Andy, they're bringing in Heynckes for a temporary role.
Well, until the end of the season. Mm-hmm. It's just a placeholder until they can get Nagelsmann at the end of the season, who they always wanted. The idea was for Ancelotti to see it through to the end of the season until he lost so much confidence that they had to get rid of him. Pep approved, Uli Hoeneß said earlier this week. And why wouldn't he be? Of course, he was the last man to win the treble. But I think if people are expecting that from Heynckes again, and of course, you know, he's one of the legends, not just of Bayern, but of the Bundesliga. Only Otto Rehagel has coached more Bundesliga games than him. He's coached well over 600. It's kind of a shame, I think, that he's going to have to come back having signed off on the treble. Even if he didn't want to go, he was pushed out by the appointment of Guardiola. The fact that that's the perfect way to sign off from any career, with that 2013 treble. I mean, people, because of that 2013 treble, forget his first season back at Bayern, 2011-12, when it was kind of a shambles. And, you know, they ended up losing the double to Dortmund. Dortmund won the league and then beat them 5-2 in the Pokal final. So I think if people are expecting that sort of 2012-2013 standard, well, there are a few things to be sorted out upstairs and in the dressing room before that happens.
Before we do feedback corner and questions, we've done the Next Generation series, two lists of players born in the year 2000, which is depressing, who look to be among the best in their age groups. One list with one young player from each of the 20 Premier League clubs and 60 players from across world football, including Vinicius Jr., who's been signed by Real Madrid. Hopefully I've pronounced that correctly. The Romanian Donnarumma. And Timothy Weah, George's son, who turns out for the United States youth sides. Check it out. It's an interactive article with lots of information. All right, feedback corner and questions. Arsenal View says, with Everton underperforming, which club would take the coveted seventh position? I currently fancy a bet on Newcastle to do that. What do you reckon? Because we, Barry and I, agreed that the one thing you could absolutely agree on this season was that Everton would finish seventh, no higher and no lower.
As this is a question about Newcastle, I mean, I don't think, I'm in the middle of two Sunderland fans here. I think I should probably have first dibs on this, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they're not going to finish seventh. Of course they're not. They haven't got nearly good enough a squad. I mean, they've had a little purple patch, but their aim has still got to be staying up.
Watford? Who could get that seventh
Watford
position?
That could be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, Watford's a good shout. Okay. Maybe
West Brom.
West Brom, yeah.
Okay. I think Newcastle should be aiming higher than that.
I see what you're doing.
Feedback corner here. Jackie Oatley posted a photo from the studio, which we don't often post, and the table we're sitting at. Somebody wrote in to say, from the outside looking in, it seems like the podcast equivalent of a football pitch surrounded by a running track. This bit. Cue questions about the atmosphere of the pod, and does this running track around the table affect, you know, the fans and how they feel about the pod?
Real Sociedad have tried to address that, haven't they? Because they've got that running track at Anoeta, which is, as Sid was saying a while back, they've tried to do something to bring it in, to bring the fans a little bit closer.
Of Jake Adderinberg. They've built an extra stand and just put it inside rather than outside.
Well, if we're going to affect some sort of Anoeta type change, I think Jonathan should start it by getting on the table, don't you?
Will you?
No.
Okay. On commuting.
But what I would say is, we're old enough to remember the old studio, which is much more atmospheric than this one.
Well, that was, to all intents and purposes, a
cupboard with egg boxes.
A cupboard with egg boxes on the wall, and one of those old tape machines that you just press the red button.
Oh, the good old days, eh?
It's like pirate radio.
But we want a boat out in the North Sea.
See, we've never really done it without the running track, so we don't know. If we removed the running track, maybe just the atmosphere would be much, much better.
Belmondo's brother on commuting footballers. He says he says Jermaine Pennant can regularly be spotted at Stoke-on-Trent station on Saturday mornings dressed in his Billericay tracksuit en route to wherever the Ricky are playing that afternoon.
Is he singing the world's greatest?
Oh, I hope so.
Sing it!
And on the subject of this podcast being too long, which it may be again. And if it isn't, congratulations to producers Jonathan and Mel for editing it down into anything less than an hour and a half. Yellow Ball says, for me, an hour and 20 is too long. My gym session is half an hour and the walk to and from the gym is 15 minutes. There is 20 minutes of material to fit in somewhere. Roy the Rover's counters to say when the pod is 80 minutes or longer, he plays it at 1.5 speed.
That's sensible.
He says, Paul McInnes is nearly impossible to understand, given he's really already at 1.5 speed. Barry, in contrast, sounds sober. And like, he hasn't just come back from the pub. Listen, Barry.
Sorry, I would say to the person who's complaining that it's too long, and just, I listen to Kermode and Mayo every week. It's invariably 2 hours long. You know, if I'm finished doing something and can no longer listen to it, I turn it off. And then listen to more of it later. It's,
or just do some stretching. If you only go to the gym for half an hour.
Yeah, what can you do in half an hour?
It's a very good point.
A light sweat, is it?
Lazy.
Yeah,
lazy.
So he basically needs to work harder in the gym, he or she.
Yellow balls.
Yellow balls.
I probably should run to the gym and run home as well. If you're walking to the gym.
But hang on, if he's running to the gym,
that's
that reduces
take time
the time,
off.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
We want him to extend the time.
To do weights or stretching
just
in
the gym. Just do 5 extra reps of everything. Yellow balls will be fine.
By lengthening the podcast, we are solving the obesity crisis.
So, yellow balls, spend longer in the gym, you lardy git.
Pots and kettles. Barry, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Andy, thanks.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.